Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. I thought I'd begin today's program by reading some comments from a listener from Canada. This person writes, "Good day, JBL. I can't tell you how excited I am for this program. I am thoroughly enjoying the forums and the different perspectives people have. It reminds me when I was in university majoring in English. So long ago, but I'm not quite to the 60s plus club, more like late adolescence." Well, I wonder how honest they're being. "I wanted to share some thoughts I had, but have to admit, this was the first time I had read this. Being a Canadian, we didn't have much exposure to American writers. I can't say I was a huge fan of The Old Man and the Sea, but it did make me think. One thing that stood out to me was how masterfully Hemingway depicted his main character. He really brought him alive in my mind, and I think he deliberately chose not to have many details describing Santiago's bare surroundings because his life itself had nothing elaborate in it. He slept and went out to sea. I think Santiago felt more at home on the sea. It was his life. His life was the sea, and the sea was his life. Listening to you describe Hemingway and the struggles he was having at this time, no doubt the loneliness and the desire to get away from his current status and run of bad luck was typed by Santiago's determination to go out alone as far as he could to turn things around and silence the critics. Finally, a note about the sharks being a type of the critics who were surrounding and ridiculing Hemingway. Just as the sharks attacked and killed Santiago's hopes and dreams by leaving only the skeletal remains, so the critics hoped to shatter Hemingway. Ironically, the tide turned, and he received a Pulitzer Prize and the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1954, and his legacy lives. Just as the skeletal remains of the Marlin were a stark testament to Santiago's determination, as they couldn't deny what he had done. Here was tangible proof that also stood the test of time, and no doubt the legacy of what he had done lived on in the community. Sorry for the length of this email, but you've stoked my love for literature." So thank you for that comment, and I hope to get more of those. So I really appreciate comments coming in, and again, we're not opposed to negative, but we really do love the positive a lot more. By now, all of you that are out there participating with JBL, you should have completed parts 1 and 2 of the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. Now, in our panels, we're going to discuss these two sections in detail. To me, the third section maybe isn't as important, but we'll still spend some time with that. But it is sections 1 and 2 that you really should concentrate on. Now, I'd also like to hear if any of you have connected with some reading buddies and have already begun discussing the book. Let me know how that's going. It's really great when we get involved with reading, if we're reading in with other people, and then you can really have some good conversation. And that's really what we want. We want to have people stay away from gossip, get out of the junky stuff on the radio, get your mind off the news and get your mind on something different to give yourself a little break. Now, with Ben Franklin's book, we have moved out of fiction into nonfiction. And of course, you know, autobiography is only one of the nonfiction categories. There are several of them. For example, in nonfiction, we also, besides autobiography, we have biography. And generally, biography is written by someone else about someone else. It's not as autobiography. Autobiography is written by one person. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But there's also memoirs are also considered nonfiction. There is creative nonfiction. There's diaries and journals are also considered nonfiction. Essays are considered nonfiction, and we will be going after some essays probably in the fall. And also there's history or popular history. And just as we maybe look ahead for the next couple of months, what I'm planning to do is, since my wife and I are going to be in England for the last half of May, we plan to tackle Shakespeare, and we're already getting ready. We're already doing the planning on, we're probably going to do some man on the street interviews while we're there. We're going to go some historical sites related to Shakespeare's plays, probably one in particular with Richard III and the Battle of Bosworth. And so we're going to do some, maybe a radio program right from that site. But of course, with Shakespeare, we're moving into poetry and reading plays. Then after that, I do want to move into a current events book, or as they say in nonfiction categories, popular history. Now, I'm not going to announce what that book is yet. I maybe build a little bit of suspense in you, but I think you're going to enjoy it. And it will tie in, I think, could tie in with what's happening in American politics, and especially with one of the candidates and what's happening with the election. So we'll see what transposes in, I guess, June and July. But here's the definition of autobiography, and I thought it might be good to go through this. Hopefully this isn't insulting to everybody or to some people out there. I know that we probably have some real literature people out there, but we also have some beginners that are just reading, starting to read, and I know there are some people in homeschool that are using this radio program to help them with their classes. So here's the definition of autobiography, and I'm going to give you three of them. And what I want you to do is I want to think about what you're reading from Benjamin Franklin and just see if it measures up. Here's the first definition. Quote, the biography of a person written by that person. That's a real simple definition from Merriam-Webster. Here's another one. It says, a history of a person's life written or told by that person. Again, very similar to Merriam-Webster, but that's from dictionary.com. And now here is another one, an account of the writer's own life. And so that assumes that you know how to read, and what it means is the writer is writing about his own life. Now, does Ben Franklin's autobiography measure up to these definitions? Well, let's just go through it. In the book, Ben does write about himself, so it does square with the first definition, which is the biography of a person written by that person. Ben does write about some history of his life, so it does fit the second definition, and that means a history of a person's life written or told by that person. And then the third definition, or the third part, as a writer, Ben does give us some accounts of his own life, so it matches the third definition. Now, I think we know, and I think I've said this before, that Ben did exhibit his talent for writing very early on, and we'll discuss that certainly in our panel discussions, and the panels are getting ready, by the way, so hopefully you're getting ready as well. I've been in contact with some of them, and they're really up for discussing this little book. Now, here's one of the conundrums with the book, and this is just something you need to think about and analyze as you read the book. If Ben's writing an autobiography, and if we have to rely on the autobiography of Ben Franklin to get to know Ben Franklin, there's very little in there that we can really get to know him. There's just not a lot there. Now, I think I talked about this last time, but it's worth repeating. Ben Franklin lived to be 84 years old. He started writing his autobiography when he was around 64 or 65, so that's interesting. I'm hoping I live to 84, but I'm going to be 64 in May. So it would be like me sitting down and beginning to write my autobiography. But even after age 64, he lived another 20 years. And the thing is that is most interesting to me is he lived during one of the most exciting times in American history. I mean, this is he lived at the very beginning of this world's greatest superpower. And he was intimately involved with the establishment of the United States. He was involved with the writing of the Declaration of Independence. He was directly involved with writing the United States Constitution. But his autobiography is only 136 pages. Now, that really doesn't make a lot of sense if you look at it realistically or if you look at it logically. So his book is really short on, let's say, historical details of his life. But was Mr. Franklin just being humble? I mean, I think that's a fair question. Well, he didn't want to write a lot, so he wrote 136 pages. Well, I don't believe that. That's not really true. And as we get into part two, you're going to discover that Ben Franklin does talk about humility as a virtue to be pursued, but it is kind of tongue-in-cheek. It was number 13 on his list of virtues, so it was the last of the list. And if you read the biographies that I've been recommending, there is the one by Walter Isaacson, and then there's the one by H.W. Brands. And if you go to JB Literature 1, I think I have those titles already listed for you, and you can find the titles there. But if you know anything about how people viewed Ben Franklin, they really didn't view him as a very humble person. And so I don't believe he stuck to 136 pages just because he was a humble guy. Now, if you look at Ben's life, and I think we talked a little bit about this last time, and maybe didn't bring specifics out, but he did a lot in his life, and there's a lot of things that he did for us that we're still benefiting from today. And, you know, he is considered a founding father of this country, and in many ways, he was as much a president for not being a president. I mean, he had that much influence over how things got established. But here's some of the things he accomplished in his life. Ben Franklin was the first printer to experiment with doing political cartoons. And you can find this on the internet. It's a very famous cartoon about the colonies, which said "Join or Die." And it's a snake all cut in pieces and, you know, trying to say, look, you either join together or you're going to die. And I know that when I grew up as a boy, I believed that, you know, you had to really cut the head off a snake if you're going to kill the snake. And you could cut it apart, but if you didn't kill the head, the snake didn't die. So he has all that in there. Of course, everyone that's really into literature knows that he was very famous for Poor Richard's Almanac. I mean, that almanac he published once a year for 25 years, and it sold as many as 10,000 copies a year. Even Napoleon Bonaparte considered that a very significant work and actually had it translated into Italian and Slovene so that people could read it. So he actually became very famous and actually very wealthy because of that. One thing we still enjoy today is Ben Franklin did invent the lightning rod. And there are a lot of buildings are not burned down because of the lightning rod. And, you know, that's really very exciting. But, you know, Ben was really an interesting character. He also he invented the glass harmonica. And the music on that is really beautiful. They're still around today in museums. He also did some medical inventions. I won't go into some of the detail because it's kind of gross, but he did invent the odometer, which we use in our cars. He was able to track the miles on wagons. He built the long arm, which is great for librarians because you can reach up to the top shelves with this long arm and pull a book down. And so it is kind of interesting. He was a very practical guy. He invented the Franklin stove, which produced more heat and less smoke than any ordinary fireplace. He wrote the document to repeal the Stamp Act, and that's at the time of the Tea Party. And so he was very productive with that. He was on the committee of five people to draft the Declaration of Independence. He did also was a participant. He was the Pennsylvania representative for the Second Continental Congress. And also, he was able to work with France as an ambassador to France and get their support for the United States once we became a nation. He was also the first postmaster general for this country, and he helped to established the University of Pennsylvania, which is still considered a very good school in this country. And like I said, he really was so important in the establishment of America. He definitely was considered the president without actually being elected a president. He's like one of the presidents. And I was just reading something the other day, and it was kind of there was a little mistake in it, where someone posted on Facebook, "Do you agree that only the presidents should be on the faces on American money?" And of course, they have Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton there, and neither one of them were presidents. So I thought, well, okay, it's Facebook. I guess we can accept that. It's like Wikipedia, you know. So anyway, there's a lot to Ben's life that, you know, we don't get from this autobiography, but that does not make it any less important. So here's a question you might be asking in your mind. So if the book isn't very big, if it's really scanty on historical details, why should we bother reading it on JBL? I mean, that's a good question. I know some of you have not been as violent against it as they were for Old Man in the Sea. I know a lot of people wrote and said, why are we reading this book? It's just a bad book. And then all of a sudden, by the end of the how many programs we did on, they're saying, wow, this was a really great book. So anyway, Ben Franklin had a very specific reason for writing his autobiography, and it really wasn't just to give us an account of his personal history. And, you know, I think you can see that. I want to read to you a quote from an autobiography. This is another very interesting, very worthwhile reading autobiography, and it's by our namesake for Herbert W. Armstrong College. Remember, here we are at KPCG, but we're broadcasting from Herbert W. Armstrong College here in North Edmond. And Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong lived a long life, actually lived longer than Benjamin Franklin did. Ben Franklin lived 84 years. Mr. Armstrong lived 93 years. And he lived, he was born in the late 1890s. He lived through the horse and buggy age. He lived through the atomic age, and he lived all the way through into the space age. But here's what he says about Ben Franklin's autobiography and his autobiography. And this is a very important piece of literature for all of those of us that have joined with Mr. Armstrong in doing his work and supporting his work, because we believe it's God's work. But here's what he says. This is on page 8 of his autobiography. He says, "As a young man, I read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography 3 times over a period of a few years. It had a considerable impact and influence on my life. I owe much to having read it. The reading of life experiences of many other men, whether biography or autobiography, have been of great value and inspiration." And so here is one of the most successful men we consider to have lived in the 20th century. He certainly was the most significant theologian of the 20th century. And millions of people read what he wrote. Many millions of people listened to what he said on the World Tomorrow program, both TV and radio. And by the time of his death, the Worldwide Church of God had reached a pinnacle. It's like the golden age of that church. And so, you know, he attributes some of that success back to Ben Franklin's book. And so, you know, that's really important. Here's also what he says. This is on page 9 of the same book, the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong. It says, "And now, looking back on a long life, well filled with action, effort, travel, important personal meetings with so-called great and the near great, many world leaders, kings, presidents, prime ministers, educators, industrialists, heads of great banks, scientists, a life replete with exciting events and unusual experiences, I feel that the recording of all this might impart some measure of inspiration and help to the reader." So that is really the best function, or maybe it should be the number one function of all autobiographies, and that is to impart some measure of inspiration and help to the reader. Now he goes on one last commentary. He says, "For one thing, I had felt years ago that the story of these experiences might be helpful and of value to my two sons." And of course, his two sons, those of us that, like I said, are now in the Philadelphia Church of God. We do have great respect for these sons. One was Richard Armstrong. The other one was Garner Ted Armstrong, who unfortunately did have some problems with his father later on. But he wanted to write this autobiography for his sons, but it's those of us that have joined with him, maybe even as his sons, we've really benefited from it. But he goes on to say, Ben Franklin addressed his autobiography to his son, but there never seemed to be time to write it just for them. And so Herbert Armstrong was just a hard worker, and you know, by the time I think the autobiography was finished, I think he was still writing in into the late 70s and early 80s. Richard Armstrong was dead, and Mr. Ted Armstrong had been severed as a member of that church. So here's why I think reading the autobiography is so good, is it does benefit us. And if you look at society today, and if you look, it's really falling apart. It's falling apart at all its foundations, and we need something secure that we can grab onto. We need to be able to have, you know, some guides in our life that will help us, you know, get through this chaos. And this chaos is going to end. I think those of you that listen to, you know, Mr. Gerald Flory on The Key of David know that, you know, this world is going to go through disaster, but it is going to be saved out of it. But Ben Franklin wrote his autobiography for the benefit of his son, and his name was William Franklin. Now, William Franklin, at that time, was the royal governor of New Jersey. And essentially what Ben Franklin wanted to do with this autobiography was to pass on some very important lessons learned to this son, who actually was soon to get into some real political trouble. And now we'll talk about that later during our panel discussions. So it is quite interesting. So why read the book? Well, here's some very important facts. And you can look at this online. You can find it just about anywhere. Ben Franklin's autobiography is still the number one best-selling self-help book. In fact, it's the best-selling self-help book of all time. And this little book really can be a big help to all of us. And while we really should respect, I think, Mr. Franklin for all the accomplishments in his life, I think we should also give thanks for his independent spirit that he inherited from his ancestors. And he does talk about that in the very beginning of his autobiography. So I thought for what's left for today's program, I thought what I'd do is I would just talk a little bit more about the life of Ben Franklin, Printer. But I want to add also about his independent spirit. So now, by independent spirit, I don't mean rebellious. Ben Franklin was a deep thinker. He was not a rebellious person, but he was independent. Now, he did stand up to authority when he felt he needed to. He did fight for many of the rights that we enjoy in America today, and one in particular is the freedom of speech. I mean, he really fought for that for us. And so we need to remember him for that. Now, he does not talk about this so much in his book. Let's just go back and let me just tell you a little bit of a story of Ben Franklin. Now, we know from Isaacson, and I don't think I need to go back and read that quote again, but Isaacson says that the Franklins were rare in their day, and that instead of taking for their surname, instead of taking the name of their occupation, they chose the name Freeman. And, of course, they did have, you know, a great independent spirit, and that was part of the family lore. And Ben Franklin definitely exhibits the same independent spirit. And I believe all of us really need to also, you know, develop an independent spirit. We need to develop deep thinking. We need to, well, when we need to stand up against something that's wrong, we need to learn to do that. And I think Ben Franklin teaches us how to do that. But let's remember now, he was born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1706. Now, his father was Josiah Franklin, and he emigrated to this country for not only religious reasons, he needed to expand his life economically. He was a cloth dyer in England, and there was too many of them, so he came here and actually found that when he came to Boston that he had the same problem. But Ben's father was Josiah Franklin. His mother was Abiah Folger, and actually she was Josiah's second wife, and she was just a young woman, but then he had considerably more children with his second wife than his first. But Ben was named after his father's favorite brother, Ben. And Ben did grow up around one of the most famous Puritans of that time, and it was Cotton Mather. Now, Paul Johnson spent a lot of time with Cotton Mather in his History of America, and it's really he really was a fascinating character. But Ben Franklin did grow up under him, and of course they did meet later on in life. So it is really quite interesting. But Mather was not only a fiery preacher, he was a prolific writer. And the point is, the Mathers controlled Massachusetts politics and social norms. Now, Cotton Mather's father was Increase Mather. And, of course, he had famous brothers, and they were all ministers in the Puritan congregations. Now, Franklin was born just after the infamous Salem witch trials. Now, that was in 1692. And Cotton Mather was a large part of those trials. Here's a quote from the book by H.W. Brand on Franklin. Again, I've given you that title. But just to give you some insight into the character of the Mathers, he says, "With such awesome evil abroad in the land, Mather could only endorse the action of the Salem court that condemned the witches to death. Indeed, at one hanging, he all but tied the noose himself. The condemned man, pleading innocence, recited the Lord's Prayer in a powerful and moving voice. A wave of sympathy surged through the gathered throng, which reasoned that the devil would never suffer one of his servants to turn coat at the very gate of hell. But Mather stood against the tide, reminding the crowd that the evil one was never so dangerous as when he took on the trappings of the righteous. The merciful mood was past, and the rope snapped taut." And so, Cotton Mather was really, really a tough character, and especially tough on what they believed were witches. Now, we know that history shows that the whole Salem witch trial was like religion gone wrong. So here's another quote, and I want to read this because this would have been something that Josiah, Ben's father, would have been around and heard. It says, "After worried reconsideration, the court threw out uncorroborated spectral evidence, and after the specters were barred from the court, other evidence evaporated. The hysteria waned, and in time, some of those at the center of the proceedings regretted their actions. 5 years after the fact, Judge Samuel Sewall stood up before his fellows in the congregation at Boston South Church and acknowledged the blame and shame of his role in the witch trials. He requested the congregation's forgiveness, their prayers on his behalf for God's mercy. Cotton Mather did not go so far as a public recanting, but he later conceded, speaking of the man whose death he had guaranteed by the gallows intervention, that he wished he had never encountered the first letters of his name." So you can see Cotton Mather was, I'm sure, a very self-righteous man. But here's what Brands goes on to say. It says, "Josiah Franklin almost certainly heard Samuel Sewall's confession on that January day, 1697. Now, why that's important is because, remember, the Franklins were not into the status quo. And certainly Josiah was as deep-thinking man as Ben was. But the point that we want to see here is, at the time when Ben was actually growing up, there was a lot of political pressure being brought against the Mathers to, well, loosen up. And, you know, it's something that's in the background now. Like I said, Ben Franklin and Cotton Mather, he was much older than Ben, but later in life they did associate with each other. And Ben actually felt, you know, some of his sermons and some of his tracts that he wrote, I think he wrote over 450 booklets, and he did think some of them were really, really important. But this is the background to Ben's story in Boston. And, you know, it's something that we don't pick right out of the autobiography. One of the things that's very interesting about the autobiography is Ben does, Mr. Benjamin Franklin does cover some of the details, but he leaves a lot of details out. Now, one thing we have to realize is that he did love the sea. And he does bring out that he learned to swim at a very young age. And but he had a real passion for the sea. And if you look about this independent spirit that was in the Franklins, he really wanted to, you know, go out to sea. Now, I think it's also interesting if you just, you know, have some of the little vignettes in the autobiography. Ben also loved kite flying, which he turned to be, I mean, later in his life, he turned that into, you know, a great discovery of electricity. I mean, many people did not believe lightning had anything to do with electricity, and Ben proved it by kite flying. But also, when he loved to swim, he also combined the two. He combined kite flying with swimming, and he flew a kite, and the kite would, you know, pull him around the water. And so he didn't have to swim. He could just float and let it pull him. So that's just the kind of way man he was. Ben invented flippers and hand flappers to help him, swim faster. He did desire to go out to sea, but you have to realize that in Boston society, or even in that area of Massachusetts, it's a little bit different than Nantucket, is that the Mathers and the Puritans didn't look very favorably upon, you know, going to sea or seafaring or being a merchantman is like, well, that's not something, you know, good religious boys should get involved in. There's a little bit of a family pressure against him going to the sea as well, is Ben's father had his first son, his eldest son was also named Josiah, and he did go out to sea. But once he went to sea, he didn't return, and Ben Franklin's father missed his son. And like I said, this was Ben Franklin's eldest brother, and he wanted to kind of do what he did. But then when Ben was 9, they did discover the tragic news that this son's ocean-going vessel did go down, and he was dead. And so, you know, Ben's father didn't want to lose another son, you know, to the sea. So what he did is he did bring Ben Franklin, he bought Ben into his candle-making shop. Now, if you, it's not really necessarily apparent from the autobiography, but when Josiah moved to America from England, he got out of the dyeing business and actually, you know, re-apprenticed himself to become a candle maker. So they were not lazy people. I mean, Ben Franklin's father would not come here and get on welfare. Of course, being in Massachusetts, there wouldn't have been welfare. You know, they would believe in hard work and the Puritan Protestant work ethic. Even though the Franklins may have not agreed with the Puritans, they sure agreed with their work ethic. But anyway, Josiah took Ben into his candle making business, and Ben Franklin, to be honest, was just totally bored. And I mean, what 12-year-old maybe wouldn't be bored standing? I understand that making candles was, of course, part of that business also was the soap business, so you had to use tallow from animals, and I think that stunk. And then, you know, pouring and mixing the wax and boiling tallow all day, I'm sure that wasn't very very pleasant to the nose or to certainly Ben's inquisitive mind. So actually what Josiah did was really unusual at that time, is that he knew that he was going to have to get Ben interested in something really exciting to keep him from going to sea. And so they would go around to different businesses or to different shops and, to see what Ben would really like to do. And so he checked out the cutlery shop, and he checked out a few other things, and he kind of liked the cutlery. But it was interesting at this time. One of Ben's older brothers, James, was also a printer, and he had just gotten back from England, and he had learned the printing business in England. And they took Ben to this shop, and you know, Ben really wasn't interested in going to work for an older brother. He really did want to go and become like a merchantman or you know, a sailing man. But it really, you know, Ben was really interested in writing, and he was interested in, you know, of course, learning about writing. And his father didn't really necessarily support him. And, you know, Ben really could have gone on to college, but his father couldn't afford it. So he actually took him out of school, and he was self-taught. Ben did prove himself very well. Here's what Brand says about this. When Ben actually got in with his brother and looked at the print shop, Ben actually liked it. And they actually found out that, he would do very well at that. He had the right physique for it. He had the right hands for it. And here's how Brand describes it. He says, in fact, Ben served very well. Printing turned out to be ideally suited to his peculiar combination of manual and intellectual dexterity. Now he goes on to say this. He says, from the beginning, Ben showed himself adept at both the physical and mental aspects of printing. His fingers fitted from the type rack to the frame, plucking the letters he needed and slipping them into their places. He had inherited a good set of soldiers from Josiah. As he matured and as he continued to swim at every opportunity, these grew strong enough to sling around the heavy sets of lead type and to operate the manual presses for hours at a time. His facility with language eased the chores of editing and proofing. His early acquired and always widening reading habits attuned his ear to the felicitous phrasing and his eye to orthodox orthography. His failure at arithmetic proved to have been Mr. Brownwell's doing more than his own. A subsequent self-study course yielded rapid progress to mastery more than adequate for any tradesman. Here was a great match. And, you know, certainly Josiah was relieved. James was happy because he got Ben to become his apprentice for 9 years. Now, what they didn't realize is Ben and his brother James were going to come into real conflict with the Mathers. Now, I'm really sorry, but we're about out of time for today. So remember, if you have questions or comments for me, you can email me at jbl@pcog.org, or you can follow JBL on Twitter, and that address is ampersand or at JBLiterature1. So remember, in June, we're going to be reading Shakespeare's play Hamlet. You can get a copy of that book on Amazon. Please purchase the Pelican Shakespeare and get ready for that. I'm really excited about that. My wife and I will be in England doing the taping for some of those programs. And so I think you're going to find it really exciting. So thanks for joining me today. Until next time, keep reading.
Been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.